DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the news headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Gabriel Borud. On this week's show, we're going to head to the north of Nigeria to find out how the army is dealing with the Boko Haram terrorist group, and also how the people are dealing with the devastation that's been left behind.
You can't live there. I mean, Boko Haram basically set the city on fire. They destroyed schools and residential buildings and supermarkets, shops, banks. It's quite an eerie, you know, atmosphere.
We'll hear the story of Zarguna Hassan, who won't back down in her fight to make radio in Afghanistan. And Donald Trump. Enough said. Or should I say Donald Trumpf? He is German, after all.
Ich bin ein Karlstadter.
It'll all make sense if you stay tuned here on WorldLink. You're listening to DW's WorldLink. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn, Germany. Nigeria could be facing a famine worse than any other we've ever seen, a UN representative said this week. Devastation in Borno State, in the northeast of the country, is so complete that millions of people there are threatened with malnutrition. Borno State was under the control of the terrorist group Boko Haram, which made headlines around the world in 2014 after they kidnapped hundreds of young girls. Boko Haram has now been pushed out of Borno, and its leader gravely injured, says the Nigerian army. But the area remains devastated, and only now are we seeing the extent. Ulf Lessing, a Reuters reporter, was part of the first international news team to see the places Boko Haram had under its control. He went along with the military near the city of Bama and asked him first what he saw.
Yeah, we saw, like, in Bama on the main road, you know, most buildings are somehow damaged or, you know, were destroyed. You can see, like, there's two banks that were robbed by Boko Haram and then set on fire. There's, like, you know, a long row of shops where no, you know, soldiers live in. They were torched from inside. Some buildings are still standing. And you can see in all buildings either, you know, signs from Boko Haram. You know, they've wrote, like, God is great on most buildings, or also, you know, painted the flag of Islamic State. So that's left. But there's no life going on. I mean, the state government, they've started to truck, like, cement blocks because they hope to rebuild the city. But these blocks are just standing idle next to the road because it's just not, you know, safe enough to, you know, to rebuild the city. Nobody could live there for now.
So we're talking about complete devastation then.
Yes, definitely. And then Boko Haram, they also destroyed the schools and, the palace of the traditional ruler, which is located in the city center. And that's also where the soldiers, they have set up, you know, a large tent. You can't live there. I mean, Boko Haram basically set the city on fire. They destroyed schools and residential buildings and supermarkets, shops, banks. So it's quite an eerie, you know, atmosphere. And it shows a bit of a challenge. The military has retaken much of the territory they had lost to Boko Haram. But with all this vast bushland and woods, it's very difficult to really actually control the area. And they can't guarantee that Boko Haram won't strike back. It doesn't take much to stage an ambush on a road.
You went along with the military. Can you describe your experience with them?
Yeah, I mean, it's about 70 kilometers from Maiduguri to Bama. Like, the first 30 kilometers are somehow okay. You still see some, you know, farmers going to work, and there comes one small town called Kudunga where many people have returned.
So you're driving, are you driving along a dirt road at this point, or can you just sort of describe, give us a sense of what it's like?
Yeah, it's a tarmac road, it's potholed. And we were going with the military, you know, they had provided us an escort, so we're traveling with them. You know, in the front was a gun truck. It's like a Jeep with a mounted anti-aircraft gun. So the first, like, 20, 30 kilometers are somehow okay until this small town, Kudunga, on the way. And then life kind of stops. It becomes completely deserted. You just see, like, burnout tanks on the road and, you know, on the side, abandoned petrol stations or farmhouses. But there's no activity at all. It's just, you know, thick bushland, trees lining the streets. That's why the army is so nervous of any kind of ambushes. And they, you know, they just, you know, open fire anyway as the convoy, you know, rumbles along on the road.
What are they shooting at?
Just at trees or buildings or ahead of the road. I mean, they explained it to us in a way that they want a signal to anyone out there the enemy that convoy is on the way, so they don't even dare to approach.
So it's preemptive fire then? They're just shooting?
Exactly. Yeah, and then the commander later in Obama explained it to us, you know, the idea is that, you know, they want to provoke any enemy into returning fire so that person then gives away his position. I mean, we had our driver, you know, he was, you know, with one hand, he was navigating the road, the one just, you know, firing his guns through his open window. They're just firing randomly and, you know, into the bush, just hoping that nobody is out there.
What was going through your head when this was going on? Have you ever experienced anything like this before?
I mean, I've covered other war zones like Libya, but I mean, I was still a bit shocked. I mean, the trip had been arranged by the top commander, you know, in charge of the Boko Haram operations, who kind of assured us that they are totally in control. I also don't think that there was an imminent danger on the road, but still it was a bit scary to know that, you know, that they have to open fire on the way, which kind of shows that, you know, they're not really in control. I mean, technically, yes, but they just don't know who's out there, so they just open fire anyway.
Let's get into control. A video came out this week, I believe on Wednesday it came out, released by Boko Haram. And in that video, there was an unidentified man who suggested that Abubakar Shekau is first of all still alive. The commander of Boko Haram was supposed to be killed or gravely wounded in August. And also that they're making threats that they're going to capture the Nigerian President Buhari. What do you think? Do you buy any of those claims?
I think they want to show that they're still there. I mean, obviously they lost much of their territory, but they kind of retreated to this, you know, Sambisa forest, which is a vast forest on the outskirts of Bama, stretching up until the border to Chad.
Right. That's where the video was recorded, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a place, I mean, when we met the commander in Bama, he said that that's a place they can't penetrate. I mean, they've tried several times to take the forest and have surrounded it. But, you know, their tanks and, you know, artillery guns are no use on the dirt tracks in the forest, especially now in the rain season. So that gives, you know, Boko Haram some kind of, you know, refugee where they can always stay and operate from. It's also where people believe the girls from Chibok, the small town, you know, where more than 200 schoolgirls were captured 3 years ago, are believed to be, you know, hiding or held by Boko Haram. So, I mean, I think the video, they just wanted to show that they are still there and, you know, and that to counter the claim from the army that basically the you know, insurgency has been crushed and Shekau, the leader, you know, is still alive. I mean, the army claimed, I think, 4 or 5 times he had been killed, but every time, you know, they put out a video saying that he's still there. So there definitely is some activity left from Boko Haram.
With the violence seemingly omnipresent, the devastation that you described. Okay, let's switch gears now to the humanitarian situation in northeast Nigeria. There have been reports of severe malnutrition. Can you confirm that? You were up there for a week, right, Ulf?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we saw, you know, in Bama, we went to a hospital where just a pregnant woman with her 2 or 3 children, you know, they basically, you know, I mean, had just survived Boko Haram. They were farmers, but then had managed to escape from Boko Haram, and they had clear signs of malnutrition, you know, very thin body, you could even see the bones.
And she was pregnant?
Yes, as well that, yeah, and they had already, like, I think 5 children. I mean, 3 children were left behind with a husband who was a farmer, and the mother and the other children went to Bama. That happens every day. When we traveled back from Bama to Maiduguri, you know, another woman approached the convoy and, you know, asked to get a lift. She apparently as well has just, you know, escaped Boko Haram. So the UN says like up to 5.5 million people are in need of food. So it's quite a severe situation.
Were you able to talk to any of these people face to face? What did they say to you?
Yeah, I mean, we spoke to quite a few. I mean, they said that obviously now they're being taken care of, but they fear to go back. They just don't think it's safe enough. I mean, you can see like Maiduguri, the main city, used to have around 1.5 million people, you know, 7 years ago when the insurgency started. No, it's 5 million. I mean, the camps are all overcrowded. People, they set up tents now in the streets. All they want to go back, but they know they really can't because it's just not secure enough to go farming, which is the main economic activity in the north. So they were going to depend a long time on UN or other food agencies to survive.
A representative of the UN said that a famine like we've never seen before could happen in this area. Are you personally afraid for these people, Ulf?
I think those who made it into safety, they're getting taken care of, but nobody knows how many million people are left there out in the woods and the bushland, and that is quite scary because, I mean, the UN or the other agencies can't really reach these people. It's just too insecure to go there, and it's impossible for them to resume farming. So that and we also know that Boko Haram, many of the fighters are hungry, so that it's definitely a threat, the famine there.
Ulf Lessing, Reuters correspondent in Nigeria, speaking to us there from his base in Lagos.
Es ist sicherlich absurd, in dieser Welt zu leben. Sie erscheint dir sinnentleert, doch zieh dich nicht zurück. Spontane Rebellion und Solidarität sind Akte, die jetzt wertvoll sind. Es ist nie zu spät. Lang ist es rum. Es ist sicherlich absurd, in dieser Welt zu leben. Sie erscheint dir sinnentleert, doch zieh dich nicht zurück. Spontane Rebellion und Solidarität sind Akte, die jetzt wertvoll sind. Es ist nie zu spät. Lang ist es rum. Das Leben ist kurz. Lang ist es kurz.
We're going to head to Afghanistan's capital now to meet Zarguna Hassan, a brave woman who runs two radio programs for women and young people in her country. Before we get into her story, though, here's a bit of background. Hassan used to live in Kunduz, where the German military was based in Afghanistan during the NATO ISAF mission. When they left, the Taliban took control of Kunduz and burned her radio station down. She fled to the capital, Kabul, and now her programs are up and running again. Don't back down, she says. Sarah Steffen has more about Zarguna Hassan.
I've only been back home once since I fled. I only stayed for a short time, and I hid under a burqa.
Zarguna Hassan tells her story over a cup of tea and cake. We're meeting her at a safe space, a leafy garden in Kabul. The sun is shining and the birds are chirping. Today seems to be a calm day for Afghanistan's terror-stricken capital. Hassan used to be the radio voice of Kunduz in Afghanistan's northeast. She recalls the attacks last fall when her radio station went up in flames. But her words don't just describe a distant past. Fighting in Kunduz province is still ongoing, even though government forces have reclaimed the provincial capital of the same name. Hassan's brief stay back home, that was about 3 months after the fall of the city of Kunduz on September 28th last year.
I only met people who were tired and afraid.
Almost all of the women she used to meet in public had virtually vanished from the streets. By now, many have left the country with their families. Hassan says she understands why people leave in droves. Her parents, one of her brothers, and three of her sisters also fled the country. They've managed to go to Finland via Russia.
There are too many armed groups in Afghanistan that kill, loot, kidnap, and rape.
That's why her family decided to leave.
The
The war is the fundamental problem in Afghanistan. It's not just about the Taliban or the so-called Islamic State. It's about all the warlords, the criminal gangs, and the armed militias which claim to be fighting for the government.
The 43-year-old says she constantly gets threatening phone calls, not just from the Taliban. But she's decided to stay. Hassan is not married and lives with relatives in Kabul.
I believe this society needs people like me. I can help the women with what I know. If people like me were to flee as well, who would be left to serve this country?
She's squeezing her hands. It's clear that she is grappling with her fate, just as she did when she had to quit her studies when the war broke out. She would have loved to become a lawyer. Foreign sponsors and the United Nations helped her rebuild the radio station that was looted and then burned to the ground. The women's program Radio Shaista and the youth program Radio Kayan started broadcasting again in March. But every day is a struggle and fraught with danger. Hassan manages the programs online from Kabul.
I constantly worry about my staff in Kunduz. I've only employed people who live close to the station and can quickly run home.
Journalists in Afghanistan are targets. Radio Shaista, the program for women, used to have 15 female staffers. Now there are only 3. The team of the youth program has been downsized from 30 to 10. 2 of them are women. No female journalist is allowed to go outside as a reporter. With the number of staff reduced, so have the radio show's contents. But the radio is the most important source of information, especially in Afghanistan's rural parts. Radio Shaista used to run extensive health and education programs for women. There were live talk shows with religious scholars, politicians, and women's rights advocates. They broadcasted many portraits about strong Afghan women and only music by women. Radio Kayan was meant to inspire young people to get an education and to get involved in society. All programs have been reduced, and sometimes, depending on the security situation, nothing at all is broadcast. Many people here are too scared to talk. And even the male journalists rarely go out on the streets these days.
If I could trust the army and the government, I would return to Kunduz. I'm not happy in Kabul. Even though both programs are broadcasting again, it feels like I'm unemployed.
In the past 15 years, a vibrant media scene has taken root in Afghanistan. Big donor countries like Germany and the US like to point to that development in order to sell an Afghan success story that today's Afghanistan, which was shaped after the terror attacks on 9/11, is fighting for survival, as is Hassan's radio station in Kunduz.
Sarah Steffen presenting that report by German journalist Sandra Petersmann.
Sometimes I just feel like my father. I hate to be bothered with all of this nonsense that's constant. And oh, it's this lyrical content. The song Guilty Conscience has gotten such rotten responses. And all of this controversy circles me. And it seems like the media immediately points a finger at me. So I point one back at him, but not the index or pinky or the ring or the thumb. It's the one you put up when you don't give a f- when you won't just put up with the bullshit they pull.
I am whatever you say I am. If I wasn't, then why would I say I am? In the papers, the news, every day I am. I don't know, that's just the way I am. Marshall Mathers wrote this awesome song over 15 years ago now. I wonder if he knew Donald Trump back then, because it does kind of fit.
But I'm glad because they feed me the fuel that I need for the fire to burn. And it's burning and I have returned and I am whatever you say I am. If I wasn't, then why would I say I am? In the paper, the news, every day I am.
Whatever Donald Trump is, nobody knows. Let's just leave it at this. His roots are German. And we sent our very own John Lorenzen to dig those up in the village of Karlstadt, Germany's Trump town.
A drummer sound checks his bass drum with a sort of grim perseverance while people chat over Karlstadt wine and the other local speciality, stuffed pig stomach. That house belonged to one of the Trumps, someone tells me, pointing to behind the trampoline where children are bouncing. We're at the local wine cooperative Summer Fate, a good chance to approach the locals and ask them what they think of Karlstadt's most famous son.
He is, for me, just a stupid idiot. He has a big mouth, he has a big pocket, but nothing else.
What would you do if Donald Trump came here?
I would close my door, I would close my window.
Would you?
Him come here whenever he wants, but...
No welcome.
No welcome.
It's the singer's turn to soundcheck, and I'm thinking of heading off when I meet an American who's gone the other way from Trump, moved here from the USA. When she arrived 25 years ago, people told her about the two famous Americans whose families came from this village of just over 1,000 inhabitants. Not just Trump, but H.J. Hines as well, the ketchup man. They were proud when Trump was just a successful businessman, but not anymore, she says. She does, however, reveal a hitherto unknown and positive thing about the Republican presidential nominee.
In the 1990s, we were renovating the heating system in the church. And so our pastor had the idea, well, we have some family members who are in the United States. Yeah. And so we started a big fundraising drive, and letters were written to the Hines family and to the Trump family. And the Trump family donated money to put in a new heating system.
My grandfather, Frederick Trump, came to the United States in 1885. He joined the Great Gold Rush. He did fantastically well. He loved this country. But you know what? I love Karlstadt also.
When Donald Trump said these words to Karlstadt documentary maker Simone Wendel 2 years ago, it was a bit of a German coming out. For large parts of the 20th century, it wasn't good being German in the USA. The parts when Americans renamed Frankfurters hot dogs and less successfully hamburgers Salisbury steaks. Donald's grandfather, Friedrich Trump, had already changed his name to Frederick Trump when he came back to Karlstadt to marry his neighbour Elizabeth he'd last seen when she was six. Their son Fred, Donald's father, doing real estate business in a very Jewish New York after the Second World War, told people the Trumps were from Karlstadt in Sweden. An untruth Donald Trump repeated in an early biography and again in a 1990 interview with Vanity Fair before coming clean in classic Donald fashion.
Ich bin ein Karlstadter.
I'm a Karlstadter.
There are no plaques or anything, but if you ask, people will point you to the houses facing each other where Donald Trump's grandparents grew up. The owners of his grandfather's one have stuck a neatly printed sign on the gate that reads, "Only ring the doorbell if you want to buy the house. I'm so fed up with press intrusion, I've decided to sell." Oh dear, walking smartly on, I found myself outside the green-shuttered winery of one of Donald Trump's relatives. He's out working in the vineyard, but soon rides up on his bicycle.
Hi, Mr. Weizenborn.
Yes.
Hello.
Bernd Weizenborn actually looks like Donald Trump, though not the hair, he laughs.
Donald Trump is der Großcousin von meinem Vater.
Donald Trump's grandfather had a sister. I'm that sister's great-grandson.
And if he becomes elected president and he comes to see his ancestral home here in Karlstadt, would you like to meet him?
Yes.
I would like to get to know him as a person, to see what he is really like. So, away from the press and away from the bodyguards, that would be interesting.
Das wird mich interessieren, ja.
Would you like to see him elected president?
Oh. Maybe.
Maybe. And this is his own flesh and blood. Support is not strong for Donald Trump in the village of his ancestors, but it could have been worse for the Donald. He might have come from the neighbouring village of Frankenstein. John Lawrenson, DW, Karlstadt, Germany.
John Lawrenson, what would we do without you? And I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to DW's Worldlink.
And color, hold away despair. More than this, I will not ask. Face with this.
just seem vain unless some rise, some fall, some climb to get to tear up. Counting stars by candlelight, all are dim but one is bright. The spiral light of Venus rising first and shining bare. Oh, from the northwest corner of a brand new crescent moon, crickets and cicada sing.
You're listening to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. I'm Gabriel Borut in Bonn, Germany. In the next half hour, we're going to be taking a look at different perspectives of India's economic miracle.
All these large buildings you see, these are all green fields. None of this infrastructure existed. We grew to 17,000-18,000 people in 5 years.
I pull rickshaws. It's not a good life for a poor person. People abuse you.
Now I feel really good. I had nothing. Now I build and sell properties.
India's economy has grown at breakneck speed for the past 25 years. From the early 90s until now, it remains the world's fastest growing major economy. It was above all Manmohan Singh, finance minister at the beginning of India's boom, and then prime minister from 2004 to 2014, who liberalized the Indian economy and opened it up to the world. And with the economic whirlwind, the country as a whole has changed profoundly. Call centers have sprung up all over India, employing hundreds of thousands, and multi-lane highways and high-rise buildings were built where farmers used to grow crops. Yet, while hundreds of millions have benefited from rapid economic growth, and some have literally made it from rags to riches, hundreds of millions more continue to struggle for their survival. We're going to hear a host of stories this week that our India correspondents Sandra Petersmann and Jürgen Wiebermann have tracked down. They talk to all kinds of different Indians to find out how the economic miracle has impacted them. Their in-depth report is presented by DW's Helen Sini.
Mangiram gets out of his brand new Range Rover, mobile phone glued to his ear. He's wearing white jeans and dabs a speck of dust from his patent leather shoes. Natapur is much like other small towns and villages in India, densely packed with little shops under brightly coloured hoardings, piles of rubbish, rickshaws, people and cows. The houses have flat roofs, their walls are cracked by the monsoon. Many of the streets are bare dirt roads. Mangiram knows everyone here. He acts as a kind of mayor for Natapur, a village in the district of Gurgaon, close to the capital, New Delhi.
I was actually a farmer. My father was a farmer too. Everyone was either a farmer or in the army. That was the only alternative.
Mangiram is talking about the situation before 1991. Farmers then worked their fields around Natapur, often still using oxen.
There were very few buildings here, but the firm DLF had already bought land and planned to develop the region.
DLF stands for Delhi Land and Finance. Before 1991, hardly anyone had heard of DLF, but it already had big ambitions. It wanted to bring shopping centres, modern office blocks and highways to Gurgaon. It was a bold vision in a country where the economy was so heavily regulated, it looked like part of the old Eastern Bloc. In July 1991, Manmohan Singh presented the government's budget to the Indian Parliament. An economics PhD, educated at the elite British universities of Oxford and Cambridge, he'd only been finance minister a few days. Singh had to find a way out of India's huge debt crisis. Humiliatingly, the country had even been forced to fly part of its gold reserves to London as collateral. State bankruptcy loomed. Singh went on the offensive. Two sentences from his speech have entered the history books.
No power in the world can stop an idea whose time has come. Let the world hear loud and clear. India is now wide awake. We will prevail. We will overcome.
Finance Minister Singh announced that bureaucratic hurdles to foreign investment in India would be removed. Previously, companies literally had to submit an application to central government for every screw they wanted to import. Manmohan Singh's reforms allowed construction firm DLF to develop Mangiram's home district of Gurgaon.
We were poor and sold our land to DLF. We simply had no other options. We got 45,000 rupees for half a hectare. My God, the same piece of land is now worth 50 million rupees. We couldn't have dreamed what would happen here. So much development, unlimited possibilities. We have a cyber city here.
The cyber city industrial park is right next to Mangiram's village of Natapur. Glass facades, office blocks, a modern skyline. Towers emblazoned with the logos of Mitsubishi, Royal Bank of Scotland, financial consultancy firm KPMG, and powerful American investment house BlackRock. Even Nestle has built its Indian headquarters here. A few hundred metres away, right on the 8-lane highway, are Google's offices. Former farmer Mangiram no longer has land, but he does own at least 20 buildings in Natapur. Mangiram collects impressive rents. He also runs a gas station, a stone quarry that has profited handsomely from the building boom, and together with his son Sunil, a property agency. Sunil was born in 1991, the year of reforms. His home district of Gurgaon is a symbol of seismic change in India. The man who made Manmohan Singh's reforms a reality is Raman Roy. He's also from Gurgaon. Raman studied in London, among other places. He came home to make his mark as a business pioneer. At the time, Raman Roy was working for American Express.
And that time nobody did work out of India. And they laugh. I mean, that time there were no mobile phones. We used to have those copper lines and you had to book a call to be able to speak. So it was a lightning call for 3 minutes and it used to cost an arm and a leg. My bosses used to laugh. And you telling us that you'll do our vendor payable invoices, you're loony, it will never happen.
He fought to bring his plans to fruition.
Before Manmohan Singh opened up the economy, we couldn't get IBM computers. American Express could only work on IBM. So the concept of doing international work out of India was almost stillborn because I couldn't get IBM computers. But then we discovered that there were government schemes against foreign exchange earnings. We could import some things. Now I figured out a way how to get 20 IBM machines.
What Raman Roy also had was young, energetic, and above all, cheap employees. And time was on his side. His team could be at their computers while it was still nighttime in the US. All this looked highly efficient to American Express. So much so that the firm outsourced some of its accounting to India. A small step, but a giant leap forward for Raman Roy. In the mid-1990s, Roy took his team to General Electric, at that time one of the world's biggest companies. Like American Express, General Electric decided to move some of its accounting to India. Roy made sure the company opened an office in Gurgaon.
All these large buildings you see, these were all green fields. None of this infrastructure existed. We got our first dish that we put on our rooftop to directly go to the satellite so that we didn't have to go through copper wire to the telephone exchange. We were working literally 18 hours a day. We were having such a blast. Everything was going well. Your employees loved you. Your boss loved you. Your company loved you. All the good things that happen, you know, whether it is bonuses, big cars, expensive vacations, everything came your way. Early 90s, getting 20 people and telling them that you're going to Australia for training, you're going to Singapore for training. I mean, these kids, their parents had never seen a plane. So when they went back home, they became heroes in their community.
One of these trips, this time to the USA, became a revolutionary experience for Raman Roy himself.
All I did with the American Express was back office. All I did for GE up to that time was back office. We would travel to different parts of the world and visit the GE centers. The largest centers we saw there were call centers. 8,000, 10,000 seaters, huge buildings, huge parking lots. So when you park the car, you had to walk for 5 minutes to reach the offices. So we got very fascinated and we said, why don't we do call centers?
Young people with good English, better trained than call center workers in the US, and much cheaper. That was Raman Roy's concept. His problem? It was possible to make calls to the US with the satellite dish on the roof, but there was a long time delay on the line. Raman Roy installed high-powered computers that could send voice packets faster by satellite. He hounded the offices of the Indian Telecommunications Ministry. Roy needed authorization for this plan.
I remember a government official telling me, are you setting up an espionage center? Why do you need so much bandwidth?
Raman Roy got his license. That was in 1998. Next, he had to persuade General Electric. They were also skeptical.
We played a few tricks on people to demonstrate. We made calls. Hey, Jim, are you in town? Can we meet for dinner in the evening? Because Jim is the guy who said, hey, this will never work. And, oh, you should have told me before. Yeah, of course we'll go for dinner. By the watch, we must talk to him for at least 2 to 3 minutes. So, Jim, you believe I'm in town? Yeah, you just said so. Jim, what happened to 30,000 miles up and 30,000 miles down? There is no lag. Then he realized, he said, oh, you're calling from India. All the technology you said won't work. Okay, it works.
And so Raman Roy opened India's first international call center. Hundreds of thousands more call centers, catering to the customers of firms in the US and other English-speaking countries, followed. No industry in India has created so many jobs in so little time. More than 1.5 million people now work in India's call centres. Following his success with General Electric, Raman Roy soon opened his own call centre company.
I guess we were right about the potential. We grew to 17,000, 18,000 people in 5 years. I used to have a sign outside my door that said trespassers will be recruited. We were recruiting 100 people a day.
The Indian call center pioneer sold the company a few years later. But instead of sitting back to enjoy his profits, Raman Roy set about building a new business. This time, data processing for large companies. And he still has his eye on the next big developments for Indian business.
See, this industry got created, those 10,000 seat centers that I spoke about. Our ambition at that time was that is how the advanced world does it. We will duplicate it here. And that is how places like Gurgaon, Pune, and then people put up buildings. And those buildings are all these kids. They are migrant workforce who came into Gurgaon. Gurgaon, there is hardly any local employment out of Gurgaon. So the migrant workforce came in, started living here, and they were working in these large centers. I'm convinced that the next generation is a distributed workforce, where you'll have a 150, 200 seat center in the middle of nowhere, but through technology, they are virtually in the same room.
Thank you. Yes, Ajay, you come on YouTube.
Kalpana Saroj sits in a 5-star hotel in New Delhi, playing with her gold iPhone. She's just come from an event for the Indian government's Make in India campaign, aimed at convincing foreign investors to build factories in India.
With this campaign, our Prime Minister Modi wants to ensure that everyone from every village or city has a chance to develop, regardless of religion or caste.
Castes are the traditional social classes that still dominate Indian society. Kalpana Saroj belongs to the Dalit caste, once known as untouchables. Dalits are still right at the bottom of the caste hierarchy. Even today, many clean toilets or collect rubbish, sometimes deliberately thrown in front of them by members of higher castes. Kalpana was born in 1964 and grew up in a village in the state of Maharashtra. From childhood, she was subjected to the humiliation that is a common experience for most Dalits.
The society I was born into didn't allow girls to go to school, certainly not Dalit girls. Girls were married off at 9 or 10 years old. I didn't graduate from school. I was also married. It was a bleak time for me. I tried to kill myself, but it didn't work. After my suicide attempt, I had no fear of death. I had looked death right in the eye.
Kalpana was married at the age of 12. It was an arranged marriage. Her father, a local policeman, thought her chosen husband very promising because he lived in the metropolis of Mumbai. He didn't know her husband lived in a slum. Kalpana was regularly beaten at her new home. When her father visited her in Mumbai, he was so shocked by her appearance that he took her home with him. But from then on, she was a pariah in her home village. In rural areas, divorce is taboo for most people. The social stigma was so great that Kalpana drank rat poison. Her aunt found her and doctors were able to save her. 16-year-old Kalpana stayed with relatives and worked in a tailor's shop for less than €1 a day.
The worst day was when my sister died. With her eyes, she begged me for help. I can never forget that image. But I couldn't do anything for her because I had no money. We hardly had anything to eat. Buying medicine was out of the question.
After her sister's death, Kalpana strove for a better life. She saved and took a government loan to set up a business of her own. Kalpana learned that members of the oppressed Dalit caste could apply for targeted financial assistance from the state. She gradually took over bureaucratic work for other residents of the slum where she worked. Kalpana became something of a local celebrity, with contacts to public officers and bureaucrats. Mumbai, Kalpana's adoptive home, changed rapidly with the 1991 reforms. Call centres sprang up everywhere. Raman Roy's revolution had taken hold. The financial sector had been unleashed. Private banks opened in their dozens. Mumbai was home to India's most important stock exchange. Thousands flocked to the city, hoping to make their fortune. Property prices skyrocketed. And Kalpana grabbed a unique opportunity. It came in the form of a centrally located plot of land.
The land was the subject of a court process, which made things extremely complicated. That's how I got it at an unbelievably low price. I had to make sure that ultimately it was signed over to my name. The land had not been intended for commercial premises, but from my work in the slum, I knew all the bureaucrats, and I had enough money. It took a long time, but in the end, I got all the permits.
Today, a shopping centre stands on Kalpana's land. It's called the Kohinoor Plaza, after the magnificent Indian diamond at the centre of the British Crown Jewels. The land made Kalpana a millionaire.
Now I feel really good. When I arrived in Mumbai, I had nothing. Now I build and sell properties.
She wears gold jewelry and expensive clothes. Yet 53-year-old Kalpana seems almost bashful. There is more to her rags-to-riches tale. In 2001, she took over a metalworking company called Kamani Tubes that was facing bankruptcy. She invested heavily in the business. Kamani Tubes is now worth $100 million. Bharatuti Chowk Terminal in Old Delhi, the historic heart of the Indian capital. It's 9 a.m. and still no work. The clock ticks away mercilessly for the migrant workers gathered here. Hundreds wait for work. Will this be another day without pay for Bhagirath?
I pull rickshaws. When there's work, I take it. And when there isn't, I sit here and wait.
This is life in the big city for Bhagirath. The shy 21-year-old has been in Delhi 5 years. He comes from a small village in Bihar, India's poorest state. As a child, he toiled in Bihar's depleted fields.
Everything moves so fast here in the city. That was hard for me at the beginning. I'd never seen anything like this. So many people and buildings, so much dirt and noise. I was very homesick. But my mother told me I had to stick it out. If I work, my two brothers can continue their studies at school. But I don't like Delhi. It's not a good life for a poor person. People abuse you.
In Bhagirath's village, there were no toilets. 20 families shared a single water pump. The village was only connected to the electricity grid last year. Nearly all the young men are migrant workers like Bhagirath.
My father was very sick, and he needed a lot of medicine. So my family took loans from moneylenders. We borrowed more and more money. In the end, it came to nearly 50,000 rupees. Then my father died. I've paid back nearly all the debts. We only owe 15,000 rupees now, 200 euros.
The average monthly income for male migrant workers is around 80 euros. From this, men like Bhagirath pay for rent, food, clothing, and their second-hand mobile phones. In 1991, around 9 million people lived in Delhi state. By 2001, it already had more than 13 million residents. The last census was taken in 2011. It recorded Delhi's population at almost 17 million. If you include satellite towns like Gurgaon, the figure is close to 22 million. The 1991 reforms didn't just fuel an economic boom, but also spurred mass migration. Migrants account for over 23% of population growth. The biggest destinations for migrant workers are the megacities of Delhi and Mumbai. Their pool continues, regardless of whether there are enough jobs. Half of India's 1.3 billion population is under 25 years old. To offer all these people a future, India needs 15 million new jobs each year. But the economic liberalisation of Manmohan Singh, who was Prime Minister between 2004 and 2014, has stagnated. Further reforms like that of 1991 have failed to materialise, while the population continues to grow rapidly. According to government figures, 75,000 people arrive in Delhi each year. That's 205 every day. The state has reached its limits. The slums grow. Water becomes more scarce. Social tensions rise. Unemployment soars. Midday at the day labour market in Old Delhi. Bhagirath from Bihar has finally found work. He heaves a wooden cart laden with goods through the narrow, congested passageways of the Sadar Bazaar. The chaotic, bustling Sadar Bazaar is the biggest market for household goods in all of Asia. Karu wasn't as lucky. He didn't earn enough today. He's 25 years old as the economic reforms.
Many of our employers cheat us. Some don't want to pay us at the end of the day, others give us less than agreed. But what can you do? We are unskilled and can't make a claim against them. We can only beg. If they pay us, good. If not, then not.
And if you're sick or injured, that's your problem. Karu comes from the state of Jharkhand in East India. Jharkhand is rich in natural resources, yet, like neighbouring Bihar, blighted by poverty. Karu's house is a mud hut with two rooms that he shares with his parents, his wife, and their two children. The roof is made from tree bark and banana leaves. Karu has never been to school. He was 15 when he left home to look for work in the big city.
I dream of my own big house like those here in Delhi. If I could, I would become a miller and buy machines that clean rice and thresh wheat. But how can this dream ever come true when you toil around the clock here and you still stay poor?
Karu's home state of Jharkhand is a stronghold of the Naxalites, Maoist rebels engaged in a violent struggle against Indian capitalism. The government views the Maoist movement as a threat to national security. Its fighters are mostly young men like Karu and Bhagirath. Natapur in Gurgaon, former farmer Mangiram receives visitors in his office. An elderly couple wanting to clear debris away from their small property. It's steel and rubble left over from Mangiram's building projects. So much is being built in Gurgaon that Mangiram, with his stone quarry, can hardly keep up. Mangiram sweet talks the couple, offering compliments and tea. They sit somewhat embarrassed. Mangiram is a big cheese in Natapur, the village amidst Gurgaon's gleaming tower blocks.
For me, Gurgaon is a dream come true. The railways, the new 16-lane highways, the buildings, simply perfection.
Mangiram doesn't mention the hardships of the couple on the couch in his office. He sees only the oasis of affluence that is Gurgaon. This is Indian capitalism, radical and unfettered. And Mangiram, the former farmer who never graduated from school, is one of its winners.
Thanks there to Helen Sini presenting an in-depth report by Sandra Petersmann and Jürgen Webermann. And it brings us to the end of this week's edition of World Link. We hope you enjoyed the show and will join us again next week for more personal stories around the globe. You can always find the program or any individual reports at dw.com/worldlink, SoundCloud, or iTunes. And any feedback you've got, please email it to us at worldlink@dw.com. This week's show was produced by Sarah Steffen and me, Gabriel Borud. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. WorldLink was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.